The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Matt Broughton, research leader at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to be joined by a special guest this week, Snigdha Nandan, Director of Digital and Social Marketing APAC at MasterCard. Hello to you, Snigdha.
Hey guys, really happy to be here today. And yeah, really excited about a chat.
Yeah, really excited to have you on. And also joining us is Lindsay Roundtree, COO at ExchangeWire. Hello to you, Lindsay.
Hello, everyone. I'm very excited to be here. I'm very excited to be joining Snigdha for this conversation. I think it's great to have somebody from the APAC region and somebody from working from the marketing side to share their opinions. So I'm excited about what we're going to be discussing.
Yeah, going to be a good one. So let's dive straight into it. United Airlines is considering using its passenger information to help brands serve targeted ads to its customers. These ads could appear by in-flight entertainment systems or on its app used to book journeys and check-in. However, an official decision hasn't been made. United could still decide not to make the move, and the company would reportedly allow customers to opt out as required by privacy laws. So Snigdha, my first question to you is everything an ad network now?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I feel like this is how we are heading within the industry. I mean, there's so much focus on personalization that every step of the journey on any, kind of target audience, in this case, travelers, is not being left right from the time when you start dreaming about your travel and you start browsing on the internet to the time that you're actually booking your travel, to the time that you start your journey, airports, flights. I don't think anything's being left out. So yeah, I totally agree with you that it seems like, everything's turned into an ad network.
Lindsay, what are your thoughts?
I think, I completely agree with what Snigdha said. I think it's very interesting. So this is in-transit advertising, which is big business, but in my opinion, could be absolutely huge business. There was a company that existed to kind of try to help to kind of engage this kind of advertising programmatically, and unfortunately didn't really work. And that's a shame because I think there's so much that can be done. And if United are going down the route of trying to use their own passenger information to kind of build their own walled garden effectively, which is what we're seeing so many companies do. We talk about it all the time within retail media. This makes a lot of sense. And for me personally, as a passenger, I think I would like it because I don't know when anybody last flew, but to watch the same ads over and over again before you watch any kind of content in your, it just drives me absolutely mad. And there's also kind of, I guess, a lot of unused usable space they could be using to target their consumers, like in they mentioned the apps, kind of on the tickets, that kind of thing. There's a lot that can be done here to really kind of target it to really engage consumers. And I think that, within retail media, we talk about endemic and non-endemic brands. So for retail, endemic brands would be a retailer and a manufacturing brand. A non-endemic brand would be somebody that is not related to that, but wants that data and wants to target that audience. I think travel in transit advertising has a great opportunity here as well for the endemic brands of a travel company to say kind of where you're going on your next holiday, or kind of like, if you're traveling to somewhere, this kind of company can say, you're traveling here, come and see this place. I know you like it because you're the type of person you are, but also anybody else that's not related to travel or related to kind of any time of hospitality can target these customers as well and kind of, provide a much richer experience. I think it could be really interesting. I think United getting into this, the article that was in WSJ mentioned, the fact that Marriott are doing it, and I'm assuming Marriott is seeing great success. I don't know. I feel like it could be a really interesting space for United Airlines to go into.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. And I think whether there is already inventory there, and I completely agree with you in the sense that people want to see more relevant ads, like you flagged in terms of that example. You sat there, you're watching the same ad over and over again before every single movie, particularly on long haul flights, and where it's more sort of mid-tiered premium airline like United is, it's a great opportunity. And as well, I think for the more budget airlines as well with the shorter journeys, again, it's a great opportunity there. My next question is what are the opportunities for the brands here, and would passengers appreciate it?
Yeah, so I did give it a thought, and thinking about myself as a passenger, I think I had two key thoughts for brands to really consider. And number one is, how contextual your message or ad is for a consumer. So for example, I personally, when I'm on a flight, I really want to focus on the content there and what is it that's going to entertain me. If I see something which is contextual and relevant to me, that works for me. However, if there's something which is irrelevant, like preferably I wouldn't want to see ads when I'm watching content, unless it's really relevant and contextual for me. So I think that is really, really key for brands to take care of, number one. And the second thing, again, a C is consent. So it's very important that you have a consumer's consent to be able to kind of show them content. For example, what if I'm not comfortable, you know, with seeing ads there or my data being used to see ads there? So I think consent is something that brands should really, really focus on, especially when it's more focused on the, you know, on the in-flight entertainment stuff. This is a time that you, is your focus time. So I definitely, as a brand, think about that. And yeah, I'd rather put my ads, you know, on the app and when the consumer is checking in, because they, it's easier for them to get conversions at that time, right? Like you're not in flight. In flight, your consumer will most likely not be able to check out or buy then and there, right? So if I'm an e-commerce brand, I'd rather show them ads when they are checking in or on the app than when in flight. So I think these were the two or three thoughts that came into my head when I was, you know, thinking about this whole journey, both as a brand, as a consumer.
Yeah, I think you raised two excellent points there. The first one is around the consent mechanism. And it actually, it's a good point, because at what point in the journey, I don't mean the physical plane journey, in the journey of me purchasing a ticket to an airline, am I consenting to my data being used to adverts? And would I expect when I consent, which is probably at the point of purchase or the point of signing up or whatever, would I expect to see an ad on a plane journey that's targeted to me, and that consent I did 3 months ago when I booked the flight, that has now resulted in me seeing this targeted ad? That would be a bit of a strange consent mechanism. So would they do it in flight, kind of before you start watching content? Because I think there needs to be like a time limit on it or something, because it does sound dodgy. Especially if it's a transatlantic flight as well. Like the rules are different from one country to another in terms of data protection, what happens there in terms of who owns it. So there's probably a lot of different things to think about there. And a good point about the types of brands that would even think about advertising like in flight versus in the app, because Snigdha is right. You can't do anything on the flight unless you're paying the exorbitant amount for on in-flight Wi-Fi, which doesn't work very well anyway. So, and you're probably not going to be going, I'm going to pay $25 for in-flight Wi-Fi so I can buy this random thing that's just been advertised to me on a plane. So there's a lot of considerations. I do think it's interesting, but it's a long way to go. I think, like, you know, in terms of targeting when it comes to like CTV, I'm relating the two because of video advertising. There's still a long way to go in that. And I'm only using the example because I recently had an experience where I watched the same ad 7 times in a row. And it was a 10-second ad while trying to watch UK TV Play, which is a UK streaming broadcaster. And it was a disaster, an absolute disaster. And that wasn't just once, that was every single ad break for a 90-minute show. So there's problems that I think could translate into the in-flight advertising as well, in-transit advertising as well, that would need to be considered before anyone goes too deep or consumers will get very, very annoyed with the brands.
Yeah, that would really, really help make the flight experience all the more fun. And to add on that point, I think as well, there's the issue of, say, example, a parent sat next to a child at the window seat, the child wants to then move into the window seat to see out the window. How would the consent framework for the in-flight entertainment system then work, obviously, as well with all the foibles and mechanisms around data protection laws for children? So yeah, I think there's things to be ironed out. But yeah, I think it's an interesting one, and I think it's an underutilized source of inventory that could be exciting going forward.
The kid thing is a good point, though, because not even if they move seats, but if I can see 4 rows in front of me, I can see what's on someone's TV screen. Yeah. Like, that's a really, really good point. I hadn't considered that.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it evolves going forward. But we'll move on to our next news story now, and that's that Black Friday online buying hit a new record in the US, with total online spend coming to a record $9.8 billion. Notably, smartphones represented 54% of all online sales. Sales increased by 7.5% from 2022, according to Adobe Analytics, bypassing their own predictions for the day. Globally, total online spending came to $70.9 billion. So my first question to you on this one, Snigdha, is what should marketers consider around Black Friday promotions?
Yeah, so, I mean, I was looking at that stat myself too. And I was like, wow, this is really, you know, big, huge, and it's getting crazier year after year. I mean, there are a couple of things that brands should definitely think about. and strategically so. So you have all of these, you know, moments starting right from the time of 11-11, which is 11 November, and then you have Black Friday, and then you have 12-12. I think what you need to think about strategically is which moment is to be utilized for what kind of promotions, because the promotions are running all across, you know, different brands. You'll have to face a lot of competition when you're running all of these promotions in parallel. Are you going to be able to win, you know, within the strategy? So that's something a brand should definitely think about and see what their focus area is. For example, if it's an electronics brand and Black Friday has, you know, seen the best performance on electronics, I mean, maybe, you know, you think about that as a time. So definitely need to strategically plan your moments because there's a lot coming through this period. And secondly, also on your focus audience. For example, definitely these people who are shopping are value seekers who look for discounts. You know, they're really waiting all through the year for this time to come and shop. If you're behind those, yeah, sure, great, you know, go for these moments. But if your category is, say, affluent, then, you know, maybe this is not the most relevant time for you to run your promotions and offers. But I mean, it's getting like bigger every year, which is quite intriguing. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm interested to say that in kind of, obviously you mentioned 11-11 there, so Singles Day, which I mean, in the UK we've adopted as a thing now, because we just stopped everybody else's promotions and don't have any of our own, because Black Friday isn't ours either. It's obviously the American thing. I didn't really see many Singles Day promotions this year in the UK, but I noticed Black Friday promotions started really early, like in some cases 2 weeks before Black Friday, and I was just thinking, what on earth is going on? But is Black Friday big in Asia, Snigdha, or is it kind of, do you focus more on Singles Day and then 12-12, or do you have just like a month long season of promotions now that just go on and on and feel endless?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a great question. For sure, hands down, Asia Singles Day is the biggest, by far the biggest promotion. Brands from China particularly, I think 11-11 is the biggest for them. Also from the fact that the number 11-11 is really auspicious. And, you know, people in this part of the world are quite into this, you know, that this is a lucky day, this is a good day, and you're running promotions. So Singles Day by far, I think, is the biggest. Black Friday is not as big in Asia as it is in other parts of the world. But like you said, you know, the way things are evolving is that consumers are looking for promotions all through the year. They are value seekers, especially in this part of the world. They want discounts, they want promotions. There's so much competition. So they are often looking for these different periods. Of course, each sale period has a different value. You know, Singles Day by far being the winner. But then I'm also seeing that every single brand that I shop on is running every single, you know, promotion. So they're doing 11-11, they're doing Black Friday, they're also doing 12-12. So it's just that consumers are being spoiled with that, because they missed one boat, you know, they can catch the next. So that's how things have been in Asia particularly.
Interesting. And it'll be interesting to see how that goes forward. I'm interested to see, what does, you know, the record spend, how does that translate to the wider economic market, and say, how are, you know, sales for the rest of the holiday period going to shape out?
Yep. I think the one good thing is that all of these brands that are into e-commerce are doing a lot of data analysis, post, pre and post. And I think they are strategically placing their offers and discounts based on, you know, which period has the best seasonality, which is the best period to, you know, increase your discounts, decrease your discounts, because the value, the revenues generated from these sales really matter to the brands. So personally, if you ask me, I wouldn't know the answer, because e-commerce is not the space that I'm in. But I have worked a lot with e-commerce companies back in my previous job. And, you know, we saw brands like Shein and Rowena and like so many of these Chinese brands making the most of the Singles Day period as an example. So yeah.
It's interesting, because I think that, I mean, if I do, you mentioned that obviously it's a consumer will never miss the boat, because if they've missed out on one sale, there's another one literally 3 days down the line, then another one a week after that. But I also wonder if it's very overwhelming for consumers, because I feel overwhelmed by all these different things now. And I'm like, I must buy this, I must buy that. No, you don't need that, Lindsay. Come on, Lindsay, calm down. you didn't need this 2 days ago. You certainly don't need it now. And that's what I think a lot of, you know, financial experts and kind of financial help advisors are trying to kind of warn people to be careful, be check what you need. But I think also from a marketer perspective, I think it must be very, very tough. And I feel like, I wonder if this has got worse since the pandemic. It's very tough for them to, everyone is now expects to be able to buy everything they need during these sale periods. That when are they going to buy anything else throughout the rest of the year? And I think it probably has impacted the sales cycle. The sales cycle was always very much like boom before Christmas, boom in January for January sales, or certainly the UK anyway, and then maybe boom before different seasons at the start of summer, et cetera, et cetera. But it must be much more challenging for them now to be able to maybe predict the cycle. They must feel they need to go harder on the likes of Singles Day and Black Friday and Cyber Monday. I see brands doing like Black Friday weeks. Cyber Monday ended about 4 days ago, and I'm still getting emails saying you can still catch this Cyber Monday deal. And it kind of makes me feel bad for them. Maybe it's because I'm in the industry that I'm kind of, I know what this means. Like I know it means it probably isn't going very well for them. And I just I feel a bit like sorry for them that they're having to kind of continually like desperately go after every consumer and go, come on, you can still come and get this deal. Mm. In fact, we'll give you another 10% off if you sign up for this, and then you do that and you do that. And you're just like, oh my God.
No, absolutely. I think the profit margins are impacted because of that. There's so much competition that they can't even, you know, let this go. They're like, okay, if I don't get this audience, somebody else will. So I think it's much harder, I guess, for brands and especially in e-commerce to make money during this time, but they can't even miss the boat. They can't even let it go. So it gets really tricky. And I totally agree with you on that.
I do always find it annoying, firstly, when there are certain brands that refuse to indulge in Black Friday or any kind of promotion. But also I'm a bit like, well, fair play to you, because you don't need to. Your brand is strong enough that you don't need to do it. And also you're not trying to kind of get involved in the noise, because there is so much noise. Actually, how can you even effectively cut through with the right messaging? And will it be to your detriment? Could it devalue your brand? There's so much to think about. If you have a Black Friday deal, will a consumer order hundreds of dollars worth of stuff only to return it? And then that means your lifetime value scores are completely negatively affected if that's what you're working towards, or your ROAS is affected, because all these, and you have to look at fulfillment. There's so many different things to consider as a marketer that I'm just lucky, thankful I'm not one.
No, I totally agree with you. It gets really hard, especially for brands which are in the space where their target audience is this segment. I mean, for luxury brands, probably they don't have all of these challenges because their target audience is such, who are going to premium any time of the year. But yeah, for the ones running the business of super apps and, you know, a day-to-day fashion, electronics and so on, it is challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. But I'll try and resist, you know, pity buying a fridge that still served to me 3 weeks after Cyber Monday. But
even though you've already got three fridges, but back to
exactly. It's a nightmare to get into the flat. But, you know, I'm doing my bit for the marketers. We'll move into the third news story of the week now. And that's that, according to an expert testifying on behalf of Google, the platform reportedly sends 36% of the advertising revenue it makes on the Safari web browser, where it is the default search engine, to Apple. Prosecutors involved have declared that the dealings between both tech giants have a legally restricted competition. The ongoing legal proceedings have also revealed that Google paid over $26 billion to other companies, including Apple, Samsung, and Mozilla, to be installed as a default search engine. So my first question to you, Lindsay, is what does these revelations mean for Apple and Google's relationship and the wider search market?
I mean, it can't be good for their relationship, but I also feel like their relationship probably wasn't that friendly in the first place. These are big business behemoths. They both need each other, really. It wasn't like one was able to really have a big power play over the other, because both kind of needed, you know, if Apple gets rid of Google as the default search engine, people will stop using Safari probably, and they'll go to Chrome instead. If Google gets rid of Apple, if Google loses relationship with Apple as a default search engine, Google will lose a significant chunk of ad revenue from all the people that use Google as a default search engine on Safari on their mobile phone, on their iPhones. So I feel like for both of them, it's kind of a push-pull relationship. I think that the article mentioned that the lawyer, the Google lawyer, when the $26 billion fee amount was read out, he visibly cringed, which just made me laugh. But it does point to just how sensitive an issue this is, probably on both sides of the coin. And, you know, I think that the article, which was BBC, I don't think it was necessarily touting the the deal as anti-competitive, but it was definitely painting a picture of the fact that there just isn't competition in the landscape. And that is both the fault of Google and Apple. They've created this and they've now got to try and fix it. And I think that this will have a huge impact on the industry going forward in terms of these types of deals. But I think also it will have a huge, like I just kind of alluded to, it'll have a huge impact on the future of search engine advertising, because if Google no longer become the default search engine of Safari, who will Safari use? And like, as a user, what would you rather? Would you rather stay with Safari because it's easy and it's right there and just use whatever search engine's given to you? Would you rather move to Chrome and then have to kind of redo everything you use on your phone or whatever? Like, it feels very, very complicated. And I think that the other point that was mentioned around kind of the money being paid to by Apple or from companies like Mozilla, et cetera, to Apple to be kind of instantly loaded on iPhones. Like it's called preload. Preload is a huge business. There are even like resellers of preload. So if you are an app and you want to get your app installed on a phone, so when you buy a phone and it's the first, you already see the app on there. There are resellers for smaller companies like Xiaomi and like I can't think of any smartphone names, but you get the idea, where I can pay those companies to kind of do a deal with these companies, so it's like an aggregator version, because it's massive, because every app developer wants their app to be automatically appearing on someone's phone when they buy it, because otherwise they've got to try and advertise to them to try and download it. So what would you rather spend the money on, the preload or the marketing? And I think that the preload aspect of this, I think it could, the big money deals that have been used towards Apple from these big companies could affect the preload business more generally in terms of the rules around that. And actually, well, I as a consumer didn't ask this app on my phone. You've just given it to me. It takes me back to the time where Apple iTunes just gave everybody that U2 album and everyone lost their mind saying, nobody wanted this album. How do I delete this album? I don't like U2. Get it off my phone immediately. It's shades of that. And I think it could cause questions around consumer privacy, consumer consent around what kind of content is on my phone that I didn't actually consent to.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't considered the user acquisition element, because obviously that took a hit when Apple rolled out Do Not Track. So obviously pre-roll obviously had a bit of a boom from that, but whether this will affect that going forward will be really interesting. Stinker, what are your thoughts on this one?
No, I absolutely agree with Lindsay. I mean, it's a little unfortunate that, you know, Google has to pay money to Apple for this, because as a consumer, by default, on my iPhone, I'm using Safari and I'm using Google, you know, as my default search engine. So it's a little unfortunate that, you know, it had to involve, you know, paying a fee for it. But on the other hand, the good part is that, you know, these things are coming out in the open, which kind of, you know, makes companies alert about the fact that, you know, when things come out to the consumer, and the consumer can then make a decision based on dynamics and their perception of a brand. So your brand perception becomes really important, and therefore what you do as a brand, the kind of practices you get involved in, also becomes really, really important. At the end of the day, the tech space is dominated by these four players, right? We all know. So it's Apple, it's Google, it's Microsoft, and it's Meta. And whatever practices that you are into, and as it comes out and is revealed, defines what decisions a consumer takes. I think it's great that everybody wants to be at the front and center for the consumer, but the way also things like privacy, data are getting greater importance from a consumer's perspective, I think it's very important for brand to ensure that they do things which are pro-consumers, which their consumers value and respect as well.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think in terms of, you know, how brands address that going forward, we've seen similar deals come out either through this case or, you know, in other stories. For example, the likes of Netflix, like Spotify, they're getting similar deals. And it's interesting to see how, you know, the smaller app developers, how they all react to these stories, and how, you know, the marketer side of things, how they can assist them and get them further coverage as needed. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, so I agree, you know, for the smaller developers, smaller business owners, app owners, I think it is a bigger concern because, you know, like the industry is dominated by a few big players. And if I'm in the same space, it's a concern for me because I don't have big pockets, you know, to pay or to get preference. It becomes even harder for them, you know, for every dollar of marketing that they spend or every dollar that they spend on product. So, yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of a concern, you know, when these things come out. For me as a small business owner or a small tech business owner to really compete and stand out in the space.
Lindsay, any final thoughts on this one?
I think that I don't necessarily begrudge either company for having this deal because I understand why it existed. And I think that that's kind of, it's kind of okay. Like I'm not that mad at it. I think people will be mad at it because of the numbers involved. But I just think that, as Snigda said, it's out in the open now. There needs to be more transparency around kind of what these deals are. And I think it'll make a lot of people more aware that if I am, for example, using this tool and this tool's plugged into it, there's been a monetary transaction somewhere down the line to enable this interaction, this integration to happen. It's not just, oh, let's be buddies and let's join together. No. You need this. You give me money and then I will do this. And one has got the other held over a barrel, most likely. And then neither can get out of it. And then it probably just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And they kind of get in an awkward position. And then it ends up going to court and becomes a whole global nightmare for them. So I think that those kind of things need to be considered when entering into these kind of like backhanded, background, silent, quiet deals. But I think they're not going to stop. There'll just probably be more maybe regulation around them, more transparency around them. Certainly in the US, again, this is a challenge with big tech. Big tech operates kind of on a global level and it's kind of regulators don't. So it's difficult kind of how this will look in different markets. But I think it will, it's bringing a lot of things to light and could set precedents for these kinds of transactions going forward, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the fact that they're coming to light, that can only be a good thing. I know in terms of the earlier side of the ongoing cases against Google, they were quite hidden from the media. So obviously these kind of things couldn't come out. Obviously, this wouldn't have emerged without the expert testifying on Google's behalf, letting it slip. Yeah. But, yeah. You know, as media, we're always grateful for that kind of thing. But more importantly, these things do need to be at least brought to light so, you know, people can have an opinion on them. And more importantly, the legislators can move to enforce as is necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone loves a person who accidentally can't keep their mouth shut. And also everyone loves a whistleblower. So that's how these things will come to light because it won't be voluntary. It'll never be voluntarily.
We'll move forward into the second part of this week's podcast now, where we find out more about the work that Snigda's doing at Mastercard. So Snigda, introduce yourself and the work you're doing currently at Mastercard.
Yes, absolutely. So my name is Snigda. I have about 15 years of commercial experience. I'm actually a programmer turned into a marketer. And I've been at Mastercard for about 2 years. And I look after digital marketing, which also is, a big part of the B2C marketing that we do at Mastercard. And the region that I cover is Asia Pacific. The kind of work under my scope is performance marketing, brand marketing, any strategic sponsorships, which need support on the digital side. So that's pretty much what I cover, but yeah.
I'm very interested that you came from programming into digital marketing. That must give you certainly an edge. I think it's having light issues in her meeting room. The lights keep going off. It's quite amusing to watch, actually.
But it's very good for the environment because it saves
absolutely,
you know, electricity.
No, it's very good. I'm pleased that Mastercard are taking the environment very seriously in their office buildings. But no, it's very interesting that you come from a programming background into marketing because it must mean that you're very that your focus on data must be kind of prevalent and kind of almost inherently built into you that becomes the focus of everything you do, and that makes you, I imagine, an absolute like smash hit at performance marketing.
Yeah. So you're right. I think the fact that, you know, both your left and right brain are quite active in my job, I think that really helps. I really enjoy using data-driven marketing, you know, or using data to drive marketing initiatives and outcomes. I think that's the unique thing about my background, you know, that really supports my current role as well.
Interesting. And in terms of how data is used within the social side, how does that differ between, say, APAC and other regions?
Okay, so I have to say that APAC is quite, at least at Mastercard, it is quite a pioneer in terms of, you know, running initiatives which are data driven. I think, you know, we always look at either research, external data or internal data to drive outcomes and campaigns. We're very focused on the results that we'll drive, whether it's brand metrics, media metrics, or commercial metrics. So, which brings in that, you know, lens of numbers and also defines the role of marketing as a driver, you know, for growth for the company and not just a support function.
Interesting. And have you seen, you know, partners you're working with, have you seen them, you know, embrace that data more and more going forward, or is it, you know, kind of plateaued?
No, quite a bit. So I think everything on performance marketing side is data driven, right? When we are working with platforms. For MasterCard, the only thing is that we are very, very particular about consumer data, and we are very, very respectful about consumer data. So we don't use consumer data, you know, PII, PCI at all to drive marketing outcomes. And that's why we have this whole data and privacy team that vets every single initiative that we run. So we don't share anything externally. We make sure it's within our guardrails and framework. But yeah, with our partners, I think all of them, especially in the tech space, in the digital space, are relying on data because personalization relies on data, right? Artificial intelligence relies on data. So there is a lot of that happening. And yeah, we're doing a lot of pioneering work, especially in Asia Pacific.
And I hate to bring out the third party cookie question, but it's always got to come out the stable. How will you see that affecting, you know, the APAC market going forward, if and when it actually gets deprecated?
The deprecation. Yes, of, yeah. So yeah, we've thought about it quite a bit as well. As you know, what are the workarounds for it? And one of the ways to solve is to have your own engine, your own system and data, you know, artificial intelligence, for example, to not rely on third parties, but use your own data to target your audience within your, you know, own guarded walled gardens, I would say. The other one is also, using research, marketing research to drive outcomes. Facebook came up with Facebook API as well. I think there's a lot of thought going into this first party audiences, leveraging as much as possible of that, you know, working with CDPs. I think there are so many ways and plethora of ways that would be used to solve for that situation. And as you said, you know, it's still being a topic that has not come to fruition. We're still talking about the date keeps getting pushed out. So I'm not too worried as a marketer, because I'm sure there'll be hundreds other solutions that will come into place if at all it happens.
Oh, that's a wonderfully optimistic note to end this week's podcast on. Snigdha, it's been wonderful to have you on, and yeah, fascinating insight. So thank you.
No, thank you so much, guys. I think this was a great discussion. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Really appreciate it.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on. And Lindsay, absolute pleasure to have you on as well.
Oh, likewise. Thoroughly enjoyable as always.
I'm off to panic/pity buy a fridge now. So I'll fire up the electronics websites. But thank you all ever so much for listening. That's this week's Mad Tech Podcast.